Hey, Will, like I normally do, I just want to take a moment to tell our listeners to make sure they hit us up on social, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, wherever you might see us. Make sure you're sending us something. Also, you can email us directly at appalachiameetsworld@gmail.com. If you get a moment, shoot us a line, give us some feedback.
Yeah, and wherever you listen to the podcast, make sure you subscribe to Appalachia Meets World. It just helps our podcast, but it also helps you know when we're releasing a new episode.
They came around to me and they asked me my favorite meal. And I said, well, because of what I do, I've gotten to eat food with some of the best chefs in America. And I kind of paused. And I said, but my favorite meal would not have been one of those great restaurants.
Appalachia Meets World, a podcast about place and perspective, but always Appalachian.
And don't forget, Will, tonight's episode is powered by SOAR.
Shaping our Appalachian region. If you're an entrepreneur out there, especially in Eastern Kentucky, check them out.
Appalachia Meets World. We're back after missing a week. It's Will.
And Neil, what's up, my man?
What's going on? We apologize for skipping out last week. Had some technical difficulties and a little time.
Yeah, it happens from time to time. I'm sure our listeners will understand. They probably get sick of us on a weekly basis anyway, Will. They might need a 2 week break. Yeah. Like getting paid, you know. You can count on death taxes getting paid every 2 weeks and Neil and Will throwing a little something at you. It is good to be back. Lots of things happening in the great state of Kentucky,
you know,
in the last week.
I think we'll get to that. But, you know, one thing that did happen that we missed because we weren't on last week.
Did I miss an award show?
You did not. But you did miss the Final Four. And I'm not talking about UConn.
The more important Final Four, the appetizer finale. And, you know, yeah, let's get into that.
Yeah, the favorite appetizers. So we narrowed it down to 32. From 32 went to 16, 16 to 8, 8 to the Final Four. We're now at the Final Four. Do you want me to read them off again?
Yeah, let me hear it just to refresh my memory.
All right, on one side of the bracket, we had Buffalo Dip. You know, it made its venture to the Final Four. Pretty easy path for Buffalo Dip. I'm not going to lie. They are going up on that side of the bracket. We had a hotly contested bracket in the Southeast. It was the Firecrackers going against the Sausage Balls, but the Sausage Balls made it through. So it's Sausage Balls going against Buffalo Dip.
It'll be tough to upset the number one overall seed. I mean, they are just dominating games this year.
Dominating. On the other side of the Final Four, the other side of the bracket, Deviled Eggs went through pretty untouched. They were up against Pepperoni Rolls, which Pepperoni Rolls, everyone knows. I got one in my cabinet right now that I brought from West Virginia. You know, it's a big West Virginia product. It made its way. I think there are a lot of people voting from West Virginia. But Deviled Eggs shine through pretty easily, I think.
Of course it did. Of course it did. You know, it's a personal favorite as well as many listeners. So I'm not shocked.
The other bottom of that bracket, Southwest, was probably the most hotly contested bracket to date. So it was the Rotel dip. We know we all love that Rotel with a little sausage and cheese.
Yep.
So good. Yep. But it went up against shrimp.
Shrimp prevailed.
Shrimp prevailed. Exactly. Yeah. So that's the Final Four, Deviled Eggs against Shrimp, Buffalo Dip against Sausage Balls. Would you like to know who made it to the championship?
I would. I've got my predictions, but, you know, I don't see the overall number one seed getting upset, but I guess you never can tell. I mean, UConn made it look pretty easy this year. I think Buffalo Dip is going to do that as well.
Well, we'll see. You know, it all is based on the fan vote. And the fan voted, you're right, Buffalo Dip in the championship up against Deviled Eggs.
Oh, gosh, this is going to be a tough one. My goodness, I don't understand how one can choose, but it's going to be a great game.
Well, let me ask you this. Oh. You can understand. How would you choose? What would your vote be for?
It's more of a mood thing for me. So, you know, I don't know what day or what time of day that this game is going down, but you know, Buffalo Dip is one of those things that you can almost make an entire meal out of it. You know, you get the right Tostitos. You can literally eat Buffalo Dip throughout an entire game. That's not the case with deviled eggs. So deviled eggs is more of a true hit the spot, you know, get it right before the meal, sometimes even with the meal. And I see it as a first quarter explosion, like Caitlin Clark in the Final Four scoring, you know, 18 points in the first quarter, whatever it was in the national championship game. That's going to be your deviled egg. And then, you know, the Buffalo Dip is like a sustained, just down, going to just beat you down over time, a lot like the UConn Huskies this year. So, I mean, that's just kind of the way that I would perceive each of these appetizers.
That makes a lot of sense after you explain it that way. I see where you're coming from. I will tell you, it was a very, very close vote. But I think to your point, it's kind of a timing and a mood thing. Deviled eggs is not an all-day whole meal type of thing, whereas Buffalo Dip is. Buffalo Dip wins. It wins the Final Four, the national championship.
Oh, I'm not shocked. And it's been great doing this. But it does make me extremely hungry every time we get on an episode and talk about these appetizers. So hopefully somebody's making me one right now.
Yeah. I know your wife makes a pretty mean Buffalo Dip.
Oh, it's the best.
Only on special occasions. But we congratulate the Buffalo Dip, and we'll try to do this again next year.
Been fun. It's been fun. I look forward to it.
And back to Kentucky. You were saying there's some things going on in Kentucky.
Yeah, there's been a wave of news in the Bluegrass State. We replaced a basketball coach recently, Will. John Calipari's reign as the head coach of the Kentucky Wildcats is over. And in walks in one of our own, Mark Pope. In case our listeners don't know any of that history, which I'm sure if you're, you know, in Kentucky, you've seen that. And even if you're not in Kentucky, John Calipari seems to make national news when he does something or makes a move of this magnitude. So I don't really know how someone gets to the point where they leave what Rick Pitino referred to once as the Camelot of college basketball and goes to a place like Fayetteville, Arkansas, but it does happen. I mean,
oh, it happened.
I don't even, I mean, yeah, it happened. It's done. And, I think the Kentucky fans agreed with Coach Cal's analogy that their team and this state needed a new voice. So we got a new voice. And I can tell you, I watched the press conference with Mark Pope, Will. I don't know if you got a chance to catch that, but I'm almost embarrassed to say that it nearly brought me to tears.
Yeah, that is awesome. Can I say two words?
Please.
I don't even know how to pronounce it, but Habemus Papam. Probably one of the better t-shirts I've seen come out of this hiring. Habemus Papam, which means we have a new pope.
I have not seen the t-shirt, but that's great.
Blue and white. So that's what they, you know, that's what they say when,
yeah, when they
have a fake, when they get a new pope. So yeah, there's a blue and white t-shirt. It just says Habemus Papam. We have a
That's
new
fantastic.
Oh, I love it. Love it. I'll tell you, when I first heard, you know, it was late at night when I heard about the new hiring, I was a little torn. Like, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Then I slept on it, and I started thinking. All this stuff rolled in my mind. By the time I got up the next morning, I was so excited for Pope as the head coach. I mean, he's one of us. That's what we should have been looking at all along. We talked about all these high-profile coaches that we needed, to get. But what we really needed to do was bring Big Blue Nation back. Bring it back. And we needed to hire one of our own. That's exactly what we did. I think Mitch Barnhart made a perfect decision. I know people thought it was a swift decision, but I'm not complaining. Bring back one of our own. Bring back BBN. And what I really want to say, let's be uncool again. Before Cal got here, Kentucky was uncool. It was. It wasn't the cool school to go to. You went there because they won. But we've never been cool. We never had draft picks like we do now. Cal made it cool, but he also made it to where they didn't care about SEC banners. They didn't care about winning in Rupp. And he only brought one championship. So let's be uncool again.
I'm with you, Will. I think John Calipari did a lot of good things in his time here. I appreciate it, but I was ready to move on. And Mark Pope is not somebody that, you know, other programs have gone back and they've hired guys that are so-called one of them. You see it all over the country. It's happening. It happened recently down the road in the state of Kentucky at Louisville. But when they hired Kenny Payne at Louisville, he was an unproven head coach, had zero head coaching experience. And, you know, it didn't work out. I think what people don't realize, or some people do, but with Mark Pope, is that, you know, this is not his first coaching gig. This is not, hey, you're one of ours and we're going to put you in this seat because we know you're capable of doing it, or we feel like you are. With Mark Pope, man, just last year, BYU, which is where he came from, man, they beat Baylor. They beat Kansas. Talk of the style of Mark Pope and his innovative way of thinking. At the press conference, Mitch Barnhart said, "I've never hired a Rhodes Scholar before. This is the first." So people don't know that about Mark Pope, but he's a very, very, very smart individual.
Dude, he was in his second year of medical school at Columbia University, decided to quit and go be – he was not even an assistant coach. He was, like, basically a manager. They said he was doing laundry.
Yeah.
His first stop. So he left the second year, not even the first year, the second year of medical school, not at some small scale medical school, Columbia University, to go follow his heart and start coaching.
Yeah, Will, and this is after a 10-year NBA career. Keep that in mind. I mean, they often want to say, you know, guys want to get to the league and they need a guy who can help him with those relationships. Mark Pope played in the NBA for a decade. So, I mean, that's nothing to sniff your nose at either. Pretty impressive.
No kidding. Hey, look, people that listen to this show know we're from Kentucky. People that are from Kentucky that are listening to this show know the power of BBN. They know how fanatic we are as fans. I'll tell you, you know, this gets both of us fired up to talk about this stuff. But if we don't
If we only win 10 games next year, I'll be happy because of the hire. Because it's Pope. I'm going to give him time. I'm all in. I'm totally geeked about this hire. I mean, it has brought me back like the rest of Big Blue Nation. I mean, you don't get 25,000 people. Heck, they turn people away at the press conference. You don't build Rupp Arena for a press conference unless you hire one of us like Mark Pope.
That's pretty incredible. 20+ thousand in attendance at a press conference, turned 5,000 people away at a press conference. The BBN is different. If there's one true statement that came out of John Calipari's mouth in the last 15 years, it's "You people are crazy," and that's true. I mean, we are.
I
So
would proudly accept that.
I'm glad to have Mark Pope on as our head coach. And you know, he said it best when he said he understands the assignment. Let's go, Will. Let's go.
Let's go. And I'll echo your words. I appreciate Cal's time here. He did bring us a championship. Thanks for all he did. But again, let's be uncool again. I'm down for the homeboy coming back home. Habemus Papam.
So the question out there now is, do you want them to go play one game in the throwback denim jerseys?
I saw that poll. It's polling towards yes.
I don't know how I feel about it, but
I don't either.
one game, it'd be all right.
I remember those. What else?
I'm sure there's some app news that you could, besides that, I mean, that's probably the biggest app news, right?
The biggest news in my atmosphere, but I do have a little bit of app news for you if you'd like to hear it.
Let's hear it.
You remember when we talked about Grandma Gatewood?
Absolutely.
Well, coming up on May 19th, you got a little bit of time. They're having a special performance of the one act play, Emma Gatewood, Are You Out of Your Bloomin' Mind? It's presented as a fundraiser for the Nathan Perry chapter of the DAR or DAR. It's at the Lorraine Palace Theater in Lorraine, Ohio. That's outside of Appalachia, but it's about a true Appalachian. If you're in that area, you'd like to check it out. It's May 19th at 2 p.m. Just thought I would mention that because they reached out and they wanted us to let you guys know a couple other things that I would like to mention in regards to app news. The Appalachia Leadership Institute, which I am an alum, is actually applications are up and running. So if you want to check that out, you can go to the arc.gov, look up the academies, and it's the Appalachian Leadership Institute. Apply soon. The applications are up, so you can apply to be part of a cohort of 40 fellows. It's an all-paid 9-month fellowship with the ARC. I've spoke highly of in the past. We've had a few people on. We may have a few other people on that have been alumni of the Leadership Institute. It's a great thing. Just thought I'd mention it. The other thing is the ARC Summer Academies, the Entrepreneurship Academy and the STEM Academy for high school students, juniors and seniors, also teachers. To attend those academies. We've talked about them in the past. When summer comes around, we always talk about them because the applications are up, they're due. So check that out again. We'll post both in the show notes. And that's all the app news I had, Neil.
Glad you mentioned the news there about the Leadership Institute. Hopefully, our listeners will take advantage of it and try to become a greater part of that. If we
Definitely.
can help somebody, just let us know.
This week, we've discussed a little bit of the important news. Kentucky hired a new coach. But beyond that, I think we're going to have another throwback. Since we talked about the championship appetizer, you want to have our favorite food
food episode of all time.
Yes, I think that's I think it's great timing for that, Will. I think our listeners deserve to hear it again.
Benton Country Ham, the king of country ham. Let's get him back on the show as a repeat episode.
Yeah, let's do it.
You've had the bacon. How good is it, Neil?
Man, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just, it's wonderful.
Oh, it's amazing. I've been to the facility. I've met the man himself. And it's one of our favorite food episodes from the past. So without further ado, you just want to get him on here, Neil?
Yes, sir.
On the episode today, we have a special guest. I'm so excited about this guest. This is one of the probably most excited I've been to have a guest on our show. We have with us Mr. Alan Benton. It's safe to say now, I think he is a food legend in this region, but also throughout the country. His delicious porks, bacons, hams, prosciutto, all the above are known by chefs around the world. He owns and operates Benton Smoky Mountain Country Ham and has been doing that since 1947. Mr. Benton, can we call you Alan?
Please call me Alan. Nobody calls me Mr. Benton.
All right, Alan, thank you so much for being on the show. It's an honor and a pleasure to have you on with us.
Well, it's we're delighted to be a part of it and glad that you asked us to do it.
One thing that we ask all our guests in the beginning, and like Appalachians are big on tradition, Neil and I, our family's big on tradition as well. And one of the traditions we have appetizers at the holidays. So just to kick it off, we wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite appetizer or holiday dish?
Gosh, there's so many special dishes that resonate during the holidays here. We usually bring one of my 24 to 36 month hams home. I'll sit it on my counter in a stand, usually around Thanksgiving. And it stays on that stand until it's consumed. Sometimes that takes till March or April. But everybody who comes to my house during Thanksgiving is going to shave that ham paper thin and have some of it. And, of course, we make pork sausage at my business that we sell retail. And it makes wonderful sausage balls. My wife is known for her sausage balls. So those are two things that from my products that we have. But, of course, there's all kinds of traditions in the South at the holiday time, from old time what we call stack cakes. So many different things that resonate during the holidays.
I love a good sausage ball.
Well, my wife is pretty handy in the kitchen. she makes incredible sausage balls. And, of course, that's a staple at our house during the holiday season.
Yeah, Neil and I grew up. Our papaw, he lived next door to us when we were growing up. And he always had a country ham in his garage. It was just a constant. They had cornbread and country ham, I think, on the table at every single meal.
Two of my favorite things. we're pretty passionate about cornbread here in Appalachia as well. Most people are very partial to a certain brand of cornmeal, as we are at my house.
What brand is that?
We get it from Lenny's Watermill over in North Carolina. It's a coarse ground meal. He has both yellow and white. It's extraordinary cornmeal.
I've never tried that, but I definitely will.
It's coarse ground. His grits are incredible. His cornmeal is incredible. We use flour from, let me think the name of it. Boonville Milling Company.
Yeah.
And the flour makes the best biscuit of anything. Those are both in North Carolina. Two extraordinary products, both the cornmeal and the flour.
Excellent. I guess now that we have the appetizer question out of the way, maybe we can just ask you, how did you get into the country ham business? I mean, you are literally a living legend when it comes to ham in the country. How did you get into the business?
I went to school to be an educator. Working as a high school guidance counselor. Had just gotten my master's degree, was going during the summers. School started about 2 days after school started. I just got my master's. They came through and passed out a copy of the salary schedule. And I took one look. I think my pay went up by $300 or $400. at that time, this was 1973. I think Tennessee was second from the bottom, only behind Mississippi in teacher pay nationwide. And the county that I'm in, Monroe County here in Tennessee, was second from the bottom behind Hancock County in Tennessee in teacher pay. So I knew I had to be among the worst paid teachers in the country. And I literally resigned within 15 minutes of looking at that salary schedule. And a day or two later, maybe a week or two later, actually, I heard there was a fellow here in this county who had been making country hams in his backyard in a tiny little building, not government inspected. And I thought I wanted to go to law school. And I thought, you know, I've got to have something to do until I get admitted to law school. I thought, you know, if I can talk that fellow into leasing me that building, he'd quit that spring. I thought I'd like to do that. It sounded like something fun. And when I got into it, I talked him into it. And after about 5 or 6 months, I was enjoying immensely what I was doing. I thought, you know, this is going to not last very long. I'm just going to do this as long as I'm enjoying myself. And I'll figure out what I want to do once I get out of this business, because I didn't think I would survive. 48 years later, I'm still here and hope I've got about 20 years left in me.
So you had no previous experience in this business. You just decided, that kind of sounds like fun. Let me look into it.
Well, my family there in Virginia, both sides of the family, always raised anywhere from 2 to 4 pigs, 4 hogs a year. We literally killed hogs on Thanksgiving Day there in those mountains if it wasn't raining. That was considered an ideal time to butcher your hogs. And I never had turkey on Thanksgiving Day until I was a grown man. We had fresh pork. We would butcher those hogs, and that's what we had for Thanksgiving. And with that background, I'd always enjoyed the country ham and bacon and sausage that my grandparents made. I still use the original family recipe from that old log smokehouse behind the house I was born in. It was my grandmother Benton's recipe. I still use that to make the ham and bacon that I make today.
Well, you grew up in Virginia. You're now in Tennessee, born and raised, always been in Appalachia. How has Appalachia shaped you as a person, and how has it shaped you as a business owner?
First off, I'm incredibly proud of the Appalachian culture. I think there's something special about the South in general, whether it's the Mountain South, the Delta, or the Coastal South. It's all special in its own way. But I'm truly enamored with the culture, the food, the people in Appalachia. And of course, I couldn't grow up the way I did and not have an appreciation, I don't think, for the foodways of Appalachia. And I guess I'm on my way to being a foodie if I'm not one by now. I've always, when I travel, it's always about the food. I want to eat the food from the local area wherever I am and experience that. And I hope when people travel to this part of the country, that they find a place that can serve them food that represents our area well, because the food here is absolutely incredible. I grew up as a child. My grandparents were, as I said, it was sustenance farming in the purest form. They had to save the seed to use to plant their gardens for the following year. So all the food was heirloom vegetables. It was raised in an organic way because they didn't have money to go buy fertilizers. Everything was raised and preserved there on their farms. They didn't let anything go to waste, not any berries or any fruits. Everything was canned or dried. They didn't have freezers when I was young. Everything was either canned in fruit jars or dried, preserved in some way for further use. I think there's something truly special about that. I have incredible memories of my grandparents cooking on wood stoves. There's nothing like cornbread or biscuits made in an old wood stove. I was once asked my favorite meal. It was by a bunch of young foodies. They were here doing some filming about our business, some for the West Coast, some from New York. And they were talking about their favorite meals. I was feeding them in a little greasy spoon restaurant here in Madisonville. They came around to me and they asked me my favorite meal. And I said, well, because of what I do, I've gotten to eat food with some of the best chefs in America. And I kind of paused and I said, but my favorite meal would not have been in one of those great restaurants. It would probably have been at one of my grandparents' houses, probably at holiday time, eating the food that they had grown, preserved, and fixed for the people they loved. And when you're sitting there enjoying that food with your family and people you care about, nothing is better than that. That's as good as it gets.
Amen.
Do you have one favorite?
You know, I've had some incredible meals in restaurants. Who could not like David Chang's food? Who could not like Sean Brock's food? I would have a hard time picking. I had an incredible meal at a restaurant in Spain. I had an incredible meal at a craft restaurant in New York. Damon Wise was the executive chef for Mr. Colicchio, Tom Colicchio. I've been blessed to eat with some incredible restaurants, but I really honestly, it's like trying to pick a favorite grandchild. You love them all. And I've had so many great meals. I don't know if I could pick a favorite.
Neil and I have spoken about this before. I've eaten at some not nearly as great restaurants as you have, but even the restaurants that I have eaten, I think my favorite meal is still soup, beans, and cornbread.
Oh, that's a standard. I never get tired of it. I've often said my last meal, if I were condemned to death and got one last meal, it might be cornbread and pinto beans and a big hunk of onion.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's one of my favorite meals. And I've never gotten tired of it. I've eaten it my whole life. When I was a kid growing up, we had pinto beans and cornbread probably at least 5 days a week.
Yeah. I imagine you put a little ham hock in there to cook with.
Well, I wouldn't want to bet against you. I think you're probably right. we tend to season everything with pork here. And whether it's green beans or dried beans or whatever, a pot of greens and fall with some ham shank in it. There's nothing wrong with that. It's good eating.
Absolutely. You're speaking my language.
Bill would have grown up well at your house.
Yeah. My mom can fix
it. I'll tell you what, it was traditional Appalachian cooking. And like I said, I enjoy eating in a great restaurant, but the next meal at my house with home cooking is hard to beat. I'll just have to tell you. And my wife's I'm very lucky. I married over my head. The lady is an incredible cook.
That's wonderful. I wanted to talk about your business a little bit in regards to, you know, your country hams, your hams in general are in some of the top restaurants throughout the country. I imagine it didn't start that way in 1947. How has your business grown, and how did you get in some of the best restaurants on the menus of some of the best restaurants in the country, coming from, you know, little town in Appalachia?
Well, the first 20 to 25 years that I was in business, I would literally lay awake lots of nights with a lump in my chest, wondering how much longer I could keep my doors open because I was barely surviving. But I got a couple of lucky breaks. The first one was selling to a place about 45 minutes from me called Blackberry Farm. And when I started selling to Blackberry Farm, I didn't have any idea what Blackberry Farm was. I thought it was probably an old single wide trailer or a double wide trailer with a porch built on the front because it was down this long hollow here in Wallen, Tennessee. And it turned out it was a 5-star restaurant. That was one of our lucky breaks because it helped me figure out that the kind of product that I make could be used in better restaurants. Another positive experience for us was becoming a member of the Southern Foodways Alliance, down based in Oxford, Mississippi. We got invited there for a country ham tasting. Initially turned them down. John T. Edge was the executive director, and he's a very persistent fellow. He called me back the next day and said, "You don't know what you're turning down. You simply have to come here." Well, he's very persuasive. He could probably talk me into walking off a cliff if he tried. He's that persuasive. And I agreed to go. And he told me there were going to be chefs and food writers and media people at this symposium. And it was a tasting. And I was excited to go down because I'd never done anything like that. He called me about 2 weeks before I'm going to go down there. And he asked me, he said he wanted to inquire how I was planning on serving my ham to those people. And I said, "What do you mean how I'm planning on serving my ham to these people?" I said, "You told me that you had chefs coming down there." He said, "We do, but you're going to be serving it to them." And I said, no, I'm not. He said, well, what do you mean you're not? I said, I'm not a chef and I'm not a cook and I can't come down there and do that. I would embarrass myself and we're just not going to do that. He said he had already put it in writing that we were going to be there. I said, well, you better write him a letter and tell him I'm not coming because I'm not going to do that. He said, well, don't you use it at your own house? And I said, of course we do. He said, what do you do? And I told him we sometimes shaved it paper thin and used it like the Europeans, or we sliced it fairly thin and lightly sauteed it and served it on a biscuit. And he said, well, that's exactly what I want you to do down here. Well, we went down and we did it. And all night long, people kept coming through my line and saying, you know, I'm a chef and I'm in Phoenix or I'm in Seattle or wherever they were from. Can you sell me this product? Well, I'd been giving my product away on the wholesale market in the Great Smoky Mountains nearby, and I was literally struggling to keep my doors open. Well, on the way back from Oxford to Madisonville, Tennessee, I had plenty of time to think, and I thought, you know, I think there's a market with fine dining restaurants, and I was very lucky. I called a team meeting of my then 3 employees, and I told them we were going to increase production on our aged country hams by 500% annually starting that day. Well, I literally had a truck sitting in my back dock ready to unload fresh pork. We set out intentionally to target that market, and it took a while. I've been asked this question before. Word of mouth, you ask how I did it. Word of mouth is a very powerful advertising tool. And I wholly recommend that model for anybody that's willing to wait 40 years to make a profit. That's not much of a stretch. That's not much of a stretch. It's pretty accurate.
Oh, that's great.
What's your process? What makes your country ham better than anyone else's in the country? What do you age your hams longer? What's the magic?
We ate some hams long, but first off, I'm not going to say that my hams are better than everybody else's in the country. I know 3 or 4 producers that I have tremendous respect for that I think make some incredible products. We have been focused on quality. When I got into it, I was wet behind the ears, 26 years old, and immediately I wanted to make something really exceptional quality. I wanted to make it as good as the Europeans or the Asians, or anybody on the planet was doing it. I wanted to make world class. And I won't tell you that we're doing that now, but I can tell you that in my business, every day we're focused on trying to make it the best we know how. And we age our hams a lot. The oldest hams in my plant right now are a little over 3 years old. And it depends on what age hams that chefs like. Individuals buy these too, but most of those older hams are going to restaurants across the country. And we try to offer them the pork that I buy. I buy old breeds of pigs, which are raised on pasture with no antibiotics in the feed. You have to have something really good to start out with to end up with something good. For example, a fine furniture maker is not going to try to build a piece of fine furniture out of No. 2 pine wood. He's going to use a very select hardwood if he can find it. That's the same thing in my business. You have to start with something good to end up with something good. And I owe a debt of gratitude to all these small farmers that raise these hogs in this way, because without them, I can't make the quality that I'm making.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that you started out, or many years ago, you had 3 employees. Can you tell our listeners how many employees you have now and just kind of the developmental process that has happened over the course of the last 40 years?
Well, I'm still a very small business. I think every USDA meat inspector that's ever been there is shocked at the amount of product we are able to produce in such a small facility. I now have 20 employees plus myself. We've added on to the building a few times. When we started, I had leased this building, remember, from the old fellow who started the business. His name was Albert Hicks, and he started that business by accident in 1947. Ran it until the spring of 73. When I took the business over in the spring or the fall of 73, I ran that business in that man's backyard for 5 years. Wasn't government inspected, was barely making enough money to pay the light bill and keep me in groceries, literally. finally, I built another building over on U.S. Highway 411, which gets a lot more traffic because he was out on an old dairy farm in the country. You almost can't get there with a road map from here, as we say around here. Once I built that building, I've added on to it, I don't even know, 7 or 8 times, I guess. And it's still a small facility, probably not much more than 20,000 square feet total. But we crank out a lot of product there. And again, we're focusing on quality. When I hire employees, if I think they're just there to put in their 8 hours, I don't keep them. I want people who are willing to help me try to make a world-class product. And I've always believed that good old boys in America, that we can make sunglasses or automobiles or country ham and bacon or shoes or whatever as good as the Europeans, the Asians, or anybody else. We just have to focus on quality. And if we do that, I don't think we have to worry about trade surpluses with other countries. If we make good products, we're going to be able to ship ours all over the world.
Absolutely. To that point, when I called your shop, I got treated like I was, I mean, it was the nicest person that I spoke to on the, your customer service was impeccable. I mean, they treated me like I was their child, like I was their next door neighbor. Is that something you pride yourself on, customer service? I mean, it was the nicest person that I spoke to on the phone. It made me feel like I was home.
Probably never a day goes by that I don't brag on my employees. I believe I have some of the best people I could possibly surround myself with out there. Customer service is very important in my business. But you have to give first-class customer service and sell a truly outstanding product. And then you're lucky if you can stay in business. The business environment's been very challenging with the COVID and all that. We watched the restaurants that we sell to across the country all close down, and we struggled with them. I count my blessings every day that we came through it. I never did have to lay anybody off, and we survived it. We're not as profitable as I'd like to be at this point, but that'll come back. As long as we can stay focused on quality and treating our customers well, we feel like that's the formula for success.
I got to ask you this. Neil and I are from Kentucky, obviously, Eastern Kentucky, but you're from, or you live in Tennessee, and I imagine not too far from Lynchburg. Do you prefer Kentucky bourbon or Tennessee whiskey?
You're putting me on the spot. Tennesseans are going to hate. I'm partial to the stuff coming out of Kentucky. Anybody gets it better.
Good answer.
I just don't think it gets any better.
I had to ask that.
So can you tell me and tell our listeners, is there a biggest or most well-known restaurant that you sell to currently or that you sold to over the years that you could give everybody an idea of who has your product out there?
Gosh, I would probably leave out too many people. I don't want to get into missing places. We sell to some incredible chefs, both in the South here and all over the country. I've been blessed to sell to some of the best chefs in the country. And, Will, they're the ones that got me the attention. I didn't get the attention for myself. And I literally owe a debt of gratitude to every chef in the country that uses or has used my product because, as I said, they're the ones that got me the attention, the incredible, genius ways they use the product. You know, if a food writer goes into a restaurant and they eat a dish and you got to think about this, those food writers are looking for a story anyway. And my products are different. And when they go in and they try this, they'll say, oh my, what is this? And there comes a story. And I've been very blessed to get attention because of those chefs. I think I mentioned a couple a while ago, Sean Brock and David Chang. Those are two incredible chefs. Sean is from an adjoining county there in Virginia where I was from. He was from Wise County. I was from Scott County. They joined. Scott has got an incredible reputation, nationwide reputation. So has David Chang. And he was in New York. He's now in Los Angeles. Both of those guys have a special talent and a special genius in cooking. But we've been blessed. I've sold product to some of the very best chefs in the country. As I said, if I started naming names, I'd leave out so many because we have some local chefs here in Knoxville that are just world-class. They're not one of them that a chef I sell to there is one of the James Beard. There's another one or two in Knoxville that should win the James Beard. They're that talented. I would be remiss if I tried to start naming names, because there's so many that we're lucky and fortunate that they like my products.
I was just going to say, I didn't mean to put you on the spot like that, but I appreciate the answer.
I think one thing that stands out, especially with your business, is persistence. Obviously, you've been very persistent. And I feel like nowadays we live in a world of instant gratification where, you know, people will change jobs 3, 4, 5, 6 times throughout their life. You know, and I think your success, especially now, has been based on persistence. What would you tell the younger generation or a young person that's just starting out, that wants to start a business? What would you, is there a piece of advice that you would give them?
You know, I've been blessed to do something that I truly enjoy. I wouldn't still be working at my age if I didn't enjoy what I do. I enjoy making ham and bacon, but most of all, I've enjoyed the incredible element of humanity that I've been blessed to get to know through my business. And I think if you do something that you truly enjoy, you'll never really consider it work.
That's a great answer. Yeah. Where do you call home, and why do you call it home? What makes it unique for you?
Well, I'm conflicted on that a little bit. Yeah. Home is definitely here in Monroe County where I reside. I don't think I could live in a better place than I live than Madisonville, Tennessee. It's inconvenient. It's 45 minutes to Knoxville from here. And I tell people, if the super Walmart and the local farmers cooperative don't have it, we have to go to Knoxville. we're like every small town. We've got a Walmart, and it's typical southern town. But the incredible natural beauty of this area, the county's made up largely of the Cherokee National Forest. It's the same mountain range as the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. The only thing that separates it is the Little Tennessee River Gorge. And it's gorgeous, but there's a part of me that still identifies with Virginia. It truly is home as well. We still own our old home place there. I will never sell it as long as I'm alive.
Yeah, that's always interesting to hear. And Neil still lives in Appalachia. I actually live in Cleveland, Ohio, because my wife's from here, but I still consider Appalachia home. It will always be home to me, that little part of Eastern Kentucky where I grew up.
Eastern Kentucky and the southwestern tip of Virginia are just about identical.
Yeah,
both the folkways, the people that live there, the terrain, everything is so similar.
I kind of get the impression of how you grew up and where you grew up and just talking to you, that you're an incredibly, obviously an extremely nice person, but an incredibly humble person. Do you feel like a celebrity, or how do you feel about your success?
Well, I'm going to give you a straight answer. I've been told before that I'm humble. And if so, I want to tell you, I'm humble for a reason. I describe myself as a hillbilly quite often. I'm just a hillbilly making country ham and bacon. And I'm truly blessed to be doing something I enjoy and to have had the success I've had at it. I think I struggled for so long in the business, it's hard for me to get my arms around the fact that we're sort of better known now in the culinary world. I struggle with that, because I promise you, the first 20 to 25 years were so lean. I've never gotten that out of my system. And I truly know how fortunate I am to still be in business after this many years.
Do you think being Appalachian, do you think you get treated any differently in the culinary world?
I've been treated far better than I ever deserved. And that's the truth. At first, like I said, we struggled. The first years were so tough. And once I started being able to get product in with some of these great restaurants, I know how truly blessed I am to be able to do that.
I appreciate Mr. Benton's time, and I'm a lover of all things ham. So I'm just feel honored to have the opportunity to speak with you.
Well, if you fellas ever make it to East Tennessee, by all means, come see us. We'd love to have you and show you what we do.
I live in London, Kentucky, so I'm not too far away. So
you're not
I would
that
love
far to, away at all.
I would love to come down and meet you personally.
Well, if you ever start this way, reach out to us and let me know you're coming. I'm in and out, Sam. So I don't want to miss you if you make it here, and I promise you we'll send you home with enough stuff to keep your chin greasy for a few days.
I appreciate that.
For our listeners, Alan, do you give tours? Can they stop by your shop? How can they find you?
We're always delighted to show people what we do. This past year, USDA didn't tell us couldn't take people on tours, but they asked me not to. And I can promise you I understood where they were coming from. So for a period of about close to a year, we didn't do any tours in the business. So right now, we're still doing a little bit of it. Assuming that this virus does not get worse than it is, I hope they may stop us again, because it's rearing its head pretty high here in my area. I think we're having more of it now than we ever had at the peak last year. So it could deal my business a blow in many ways, and giving tours might be one of them. But we're always glad to take people through and show them what we do, because you don't see a place like ours on every street corner anymore. So it's always a pleasure to show people. We got a couple of smokehouses that are going most of the time. In fall of the year, they can run 7 days a week, just to tell you the truth. We put a lot of meat through there from now until the first of the year.
And I imagine they...
One thing I will tell you, when I first started trying to pick up some of these high-dollar restaurants, I would make a phone call. I wasn't using a computer at all in those days, and somebody goes to New York, and I'd say, well, where did you eat? And they'd tell me, and I'd dial information, get the number, and call and try to talk to the chef. Well, we talk slower in this part of the country than they do in places like New York. And before I could get my name out and start to tell them what I was doing, they'd thank me and hang up. Now, that was a challenge. I finally would just hand slice some product, write a note, put my phone number, say, this is what we make. This is the age of the product. If you're interested, call us. We won't contact you further. And most of the time, I was getting a return phone call by that time. So that worked for us.
Quality matters.
It absolutely does.
So people can go online. You have an online shop. They can order.
We do. We have a website. They can just Google Benton's Bacon, and it'll take them to my website. My kids were in high school. They kept telling me I needed a website. And I said, well, that's the craziest thing I ever heard of. Not going to sell any meat on a bad young computer. Well, finally, my son was a freshman in college. He had two older sisters, and he called me one night. He said, so, Dad, you need a website, and you don't even know it. And he said he could put one up from his dorm room in probably 30 minutes, and at least I'd have one. And I said, well, son, there'll never be the first pound of nothing sold over a dead young computer. That's the craziest thing I ever heard of. He said, well, if it's okay, I'm going to put you one up. So he put me one up. Next day, about 4:30, he called me. He said, so, Dad, have you checked your website to see if you've got any orders? And again, I said, son, there'll never be the first order placed on that thing. He said, well, Dad, you might ought to look. I can't remember. It was either six or seven orders. He said, you've got six orders or seven orders. To this day, I don't understand how that works, but I'm glad it does. we do a good online business, and we're so thankful for it.
That's great. Alan, we want to thank you again. We greatly appreciate you taking the time and being part of this. And we just want to, you know, spread the word and let people know how great your product is. And if they need it, if they want it, they can go online or visit you in person. But thanks again.
Well, thanks for promoting all things Appalachia. I'm a fan of yours already, because I think Appalachia is truly a special area. And I think those of us who are blessed to live in it are very fortunate.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Come see us. Thanks. Good to talk to you.
I'm getting lighter, the air's getting thin. Now I'm facing down with a grin. I've been in the city too long. Sidewalks and buildings and singing sad songs. Now I'm back up where I belong, in the mountains.